Well, hey guys.
Hey, John.
Hey, John.
So, what are we going to talk about this week?
Well, I think we should talk about these 10 new Republican elections bills, because they would change a lot of voting rules in Wisconsin. They're pretty significant.
Oh, yeah. Those really came out of nowhere this week, huh?
Are you serious? I mean, we've been saying they were coming for weeks now, and they're all linked to those Republican lawsuits that were filed after the election.
Huh. Lawsuits. You know, I do not remember those.
John, come on. We talked about those on the podcast like every week for a while.
Nope. Doesn't ring a bell.
Okay. I think I know what's going on here, Sean. I think John has short-term political amnesia, which can be psychologically helpful in the crazy times that we're living in.
Yeah, but I mean, these are kind of a big deal. We got to bring him up to speed.
Yeah, you're right. John?
Well, hey, Sean. Hey, Laurel. What are we going to talk about this week?
I'll tell you what, buddy. How about you just introduce the podcast?
Well, okay, if you say so. This is the WPR Politics Podcast. I'm John K. Wilson.
I'm Sean Johnson.
And I'm Laurel White.
This week on the podcast, what are we talking about?
All the new Republican voting bills. Do you remember?
Well, guys, you know, one thing I can remember without even having to pull up the Wikipedia page is that that is the 1978 hit September by R&B superstars Earth, Wind, and Fire, which, strangely enough, was actually about electoral politics. The story behind that song, Do You Remember the 21st Night of September, was actually the night that the entire group filled out their absentee ballots and then acted as each other's witnesses for the 1978 midterms.
I straight up, like, for a moment there, I'm like, wow, that is weird that we picked that song. And now John's going to tell us this backstory. But no, it's just a thing. It's just a thing that you made up, of course, because it was actual political news. You couldn't remember it, right?
I guess.
We're going to need to make you.
I don't know what you're talking about.
We're going to turn you into the guy from Memento here soon. We'll just like start tattooing like cases and bill numbers on your arms. And
I'm totally okay with that.
Okay, good. We'll be over with the tattoo needles later. Never done it before, but I'm sure we'll pick it right up.
I trust you, Sean. So, yeah, we got a lot of stuff to get through. I'm looking at our document here that has all of these GOP-backed bills that would change election laws organized in relation to election challenges from 2020 that they sort of relate to. And there's a lot, so let's get into it. We're going to go election complaint by election complaint and then get into some gripes which aren't entirely related to election complaints. Exactly.
There's so much, but we want it to be something you can consume and learn from here. So normally we just don't put any thought into these podcasts, to be perfectly honest. This one we spent, I'm kidding about that, but this one we did spend hours on this prep. Well, I have to say I'm kidding anyway, John. So let's get to it.
All right.
First up.
All right.
The complaint. This is from the state lawsuit filed by the Trump campaign, which was rejected by the state Supreme Court. And their complaint was about in-person early voting in Dane and Milwaukee counties. And since this is the first complaint we are bringing up, we need to kind of rehash a little bit of what happened with all these election cases for John, because he has moved, right. he has moved on from that.
What happened?
No, really, John, there were a lot of lawsuits in some swing states. Wisconsin is, we paid attention to those.
If you say so.
We are going to focus on the ones that were filed by the Trump campaign in state and federal court, mostly because we have to narrow down the list of complaints somehow. The president lost all these lawsuits. He lost the state lawsuit in It was a 4-3 final ruling. If you want to know on a lot of the particulars, you should go back and listen to those podcasts. But
WPR.org/politics podcast.
That's right. Good. You can remember that somehow. That's good. Now to the complaint. This was a complaint made in the Trump state lawsuit. And the reason the Trump state lawsuit dealt entirely with Dane and Milwaukee counties, technically speaking, is because that is where they ordered the recount. They ordered a recount in those counties. Practically speaking, they went after the Democratic counties in the state of Wisconsin. And so now all of these bills are kind of focused on stuff that was discovered in recounts in those counties, but not other counties. But the lawsuit said that 170,000 plus absentee ballots from those counties must be thrown out because when people go in to vote early in person at the clerk's office in Dane and Milwaukee counties, they were using a single form as their application and their ballot. Is that right, Laurel?
Yeah. So basically what it is if you go to an early voting event or went to in these counties and other counties across the state, but for the purposes of the lawsuit, we're only interested in these two, you get your absentee ballot envelope and you fill out some information on the front of the envelope. You fill out your ballot, you put the ballot in there, you return it. And for, what's that called? Like business keeping office purposes? What's that word I'm looking for?
I like the term administrivia.
There you go. That's
good. For the office purposes.
Yeah, office for that. The information that you put on the absentee ballot envelope counts as your absentee ballot application. So you don't have to fill out a separate form to get the ballot when you go to an early voting event. It's sort of like the information that you fill out on the ballot serves two purposes.
And it says so on the form, too. I mean, and this form has been in place for more than a decade. So it's not something that was like tried new in this last election. And it's not something that, I mean, it had the blessing of the state. It's just something that the Trump campaign decided to seize on in the state lawsuit because this is a very large chunk of votes.
Right. So under the bill that was proposed, are we ready to talk about the bill?
Well, just a little bit about the bills and who's proposing them. And, you know, generally kind of like where they came from and the messaging behind it, I guess.
Yeah, I was going to sort of try and shoehorn that in there, but you brought it up yourself. So,
well, yeah, so I
get to it.
I can do that. So the bills are from Senator Dewey Strobel and Senator Alberta Darling, two Republican state senators. And basically what they're saying about these proposals, there are 10 of them that came out this week, is that they're aimed at increasing public confidence in elections. Their responses to some of the public pushback and concerns that were aired after the 2020 presidential election. Obviously, some of those concerns aired in lawsuits, as we're going to talk about in this podcast. And so they say that this is something that it's crucial to do to kind of pass these new measures to make sure that people feel confident in the election system again.
And the Democratic counter argument to that is
that these concerns were not valid, and introducing bills to change the laws reinforces the belief that there were problems with our election, which there weren't, and also that making changes that make it harder to vote, more administrative work, office type things, as I called them before, just there isn't a place for that in the democratic process. We shouldn't be trying to make it more difficult or cumbersome to vote.
Good job.
Thanks.
All right. So back to the specific bill and complaint, though, what would this bill do?
So this bill basically just makes it so the absentee ballot envelope can't be the application as well, that you actually have to have two separate forms. So when you go to vote early in person, you have to fill out a separate form in order to get that ballot and the ballot envelope. You're still going to get the ballot envelope, obviously, because there has to be something for the ballot to go inside, but it won't be the application document anymore.
And so, you know, essentially, I think if you think about what this would mean for people who go vote in person early in those 14 days before the election. It would slow things down. There'd be basically two pieces of paperwork instead of one. And if you look at this complaint among all the ones we're going to talk about today, it's the largest group of voters, but it never gained any traction. You know, in the state Supreme Court case, you had three dissents from conservative justices on the court, and none of them really latched on to this idea that this was a valid complaint. I mean, Patience Rogensack, the conservative chief justice, she did entertain some of the other complaints from the Trump campaign and like explore whether or not they should have been thrown out. She did not do that with this one. In fact, it was so much radio silence that when they appealed that state Supreme Court ruling to the U.S. Supreme Court ruling, the Trump campaign took this complaint out. Like, it does not appear in the U.S. Supreme Court case, which this specific case has now been, I won't say dismissed, but they just, it was never heard by the U.S. Supreme Court. They just decided that we're not going to hear it.
All right. Well, I think you guys have jogged my memory about that one a little bit. I can't, you know, it's fuzzy, but it's there. What's up next?
So the next complaint is from the Trump state lawsuit as well, and it has to do with indefinitely confined voters.
So refresh our memory about this complaint in the case.
So indefinitely confined voters, I think it's good to start off with the definition of who those folks are to begin with. These are people who cast their ballots by mail because they are confined in their homes for some sort of medical reason, medical condition that limits their mobility. So in the 2020 election, the Trump campaign identified about 28,000 of these individuals in Dane and Milwaukee counties. And the primary concern here was that people who are not actually legitimately indefinitely confined were taking advantage of this designation in order to get around Wisconsin's voter ID law. Because state law currently allows indefinitely confined voters to request an absentee ballot without having to provide a copy of their photo ID. And so the Trump campaign said people are saying that they're indefinitely confined so they don't have to provide their ID. This is going around, you know, something that was put in place to ensure election integrity, and we can't abide by that.
You know, now that you're talking about this a little bit, I seem to remember there's this whole thing that's been going on related to health and limiting the ways in which you should leave your home, though. Is that
a There's thing? A pandemic, John.
Right, the COVID-19 pandemic. I'm sorry to remind
this. Does that have anything to do with this at all?
I think his political amnesia might be more broad than we thought, John.
I guess so. Well, John, yeah, it sure did, because we saw a huge uptick in people who said they were indefinitely confined. And under state law in Wisconsin, it's really up to the voter to decide if they are indefinitely confined. I mean, this is how, and the state Supreme Court heard another case on this, separate from the Trump lawsuit, but the court basically said unanimously that it's up to the voter to decide what that means. Am I characterizing that correctly, Laurel? Because I have a little, I have a touch of the amnesia too. On the wording, yeah. But that was a remarkable ruling from a court which is divided on so many other political issues.
Well, I think Sean's might be age related.
It's mean but funny. I'll let it go.
I don't remember a lot, but I do remember making fun of Sean for being older than us.
Yeah, well, we'll let that one go, John. It's whatever it takes to get you back. One little tidbit that I want to like mention before we move on here, because it's related to the complaint. Again, this lawsuit from Trump did focus on, and Republicans have focused on, all the people who said they were indefinitely confined in Dane and Milwaukee counties. But this is something that people claimed all over the state. I mean, they said they were indefinitely confined voters. and that there were actually more voters from counties carried by Trump who claimed to be indefinitely confined than in the counties won by Biden. So in the 58 counties that Trump carried, you had about 123,000 voters said they were indefinitely confined, compared to 92,000 in the 14 counties won by Biden. So we tend to think that the world is viewed by the whole, you know, that everybody views the world through a partisan lens and does things in a partisan way. But there is a chance that that did not happen in this election. I'm just throwing that out there. I think it's an important fact to remember as we focus on indefinitely confined, which you're going to hear a lot about, I think, over the next session or two.
So we should say what this law change would do, because you were just saying the court upheld that current law says that voters can decide if they're indefinitely confined. But if this change went into effect, that would not be the case.
There are so many changes here, or proposed changes in multiple bills. I wonder if, like, Laurel, we could just take turns. Just like you take a provision, I'll take a provision. We'll just do a little bit of a lightning round on changes to indefinitely confined voting under these proposed Republican bills.
I like it. So first of all, people would have to swear under oath that they're indefinitely confined.
And we're not sure how that would work exactly, but the bills, it would be required. Also, if you're under 65 and you want to claim to be indefinitely confined, you need a doctor's note, basically. Doctor, nurse, etc. You need a doctor's note to say you're indefinitely confined.
Another one says that a pandemic or a proliferation of a contagious disease in your community doesn't qualify members of that community as indefinitely confined.
So if we get COVID, go ahead, John. Sorry.
Your example is probably going to be much better than mine. But I was going to say that if all the members of Earth, Wind, and Fire suddenly came down with like mono, they couldn't say that they're indefinitely confined. They're on tour. They spend a lot of time together, whatever. But if they were to get in a tour bus accident and each one of them like injured a leg, say, then they could say... and I guess most of them are probably over 65 now, but you're splitting hairs here. If it was all leg injuries for them in their tour bus accident crash, then it wouldn't apply.
It just kept going.
I feel like in that scenario, John, they could, if they had mono and they were unable to leave their homes and could get a doctor's note, I think they could be indefinitely confined. If there was a pandemic of mono, which I'm not sure if that exists, in the town where Earth, Wind, and Fire were living, that would not qualify them.
There's like 15 members in that band looking at the album cover here. Hmm. I feel like what constitutes a pandemic here?
Well, and it's not, and it's not just
all of Earth, Wind, and Fire. And it's like all of the elements.
The bill doesn't just say pandemic. It says pandemic and the spread of a contagious disease in the community as well.
Well, there you go. In the community of Earth, Wind, and Fire on tour. So I still think it stands.
I have a much, much more boring example, but probably more relevant to the bill.
Okay.
Let's say there's like a COVID 22 or something, or a COVID 23, whatever. We have another horrible pandemic, or there's a flu outbreak, you know, like a seasonal flu outbreak. People wouldn't be able to say, you know, I'm vulnerable to that disease and therefore I'm indefinitely confined. This bill would expressly prohibit that. So looking backward, I mean, this bill would say you shouldn't have done it for COVID-19.
Right.
Which actually is another provision in one of the things, right?
You are correct. This is another provision. It says that the Wisconsin Elections Commission would have to remove people from the indefinitely confined list if they said they were indefinitely confined between the dates of March 12th and November 6th. So everybody who said it in the run-up to the November 2020 election, starting March 12th, they would not be on the list.
And another provision would actually set up a process where people are removed from the list every 2 years. So there wouldn't be any sort of automatic renewal of your indefinitely confined status. You would have to resubmit it every 24 months.
We should mention there would be a Class I felony attached to this, which means 3.5 years in prison, up to 3.5 years in prison. The dogs do, they hear talk of felonies and they're like, you've got our attention.
They're like, oh God, oh God, hide the bones.
Assuming we keep this in, we should just mention that Laurel's dogs say hello. A Class I felony is up to 3.5 years in prison and a fine of up to $10,000.
So another provision would ban indefinitely confined voters, overseas voters as well, from automatically getting absentee ballots. So that's something that exists under current law, that those ballots are automatically sent out to people that qualify, that are on these lists. That,
as long as they keep voting.
Right, yes.
And this would take that away.
I would take it away.
I'm just like, wrapped your sentence there. Sorry.
No, we're throwing it back and forth. And sometimes it gets a little heated, you know?
That's right. Here's one. It would require indefinitely confined voters to present a photo ID with their absentee ballot application, which is kind of a big deal because that is what bothered Republicans, is that by claiming that you were indefinitely confined, you got around the photo ID provision.
Yep. And then the last one we've got here is another pretty big deal. This relates to something that happened in 2020 as well. Under this bill, you couldn't send people absentee ballot applications unless they specifically asked for them. The Wisconsin Elections Commission in 2020 sent absentee ballot applications across the state, and they wouldn't be able to do that anymore if this becomes law.
And the WEC, the Elections Commission, which is split 3-3 and gets in some of the most like partisan petty arguments I've ever heard on a governing body, they voted 6-0 to send those absentee ballot applications around the state. Mm-hmm. So they've never done that before. They're probably not going to do it very often because they used federal money for that. And it's potentially not a huge change if they were to ban it, though, because a very small proportion of voters actually mailed those ballots back. It's a pretty small number when you're talking north of 2 million applications sent out.
You think the WEC has trouble making decisions and can really dig their heels in. You've never been in a band meeting with Earth, Wind, and Fire. Man, when they get going, there are some disagreements.
John, are you part of Earth, Wind, and Fire?
I don't recall.
All right, time for another complaint.
Anyway, what's next?
The next complaint involves the Democracy in the Park event that was held in Madison. This was in the Trump state lawsuit. They challenged more than 17,000 ballots that were delivered at these Democracy in the Park events, where you would have poll workers stationed at parks around the city. They hadn't done this before, and they were just collecting ballots. People couldn't go there to get a ballot, but if they had an absentee ballot that they had filled out, they could. And they were worried about the post office, right? They were worried about getting there in time. They could go to these events. Laurel covered one, mm-hmm. and they could, turn in their ballots there.
So what are Republicans looking to change about that?
So under the bill, these events could still continue to happen. They could still exist, but they could only exist in the 14-day early voting period before an election. The location of the events would be restricted to a site as near as practicable, which is my new favorite word, to the municipal clerk's office. And people bringing their ballots to the event could only bring their ballot or a ballot for a member of their family.
So do we know what practicable means in this case, though? Like, what is anything defined there?
I was going to say,
I think it just means like it needs to be close to the clerk's office, and practicable means like you don't have to have it on the lawn of the clerk's office if that's not a reasonable place to have it, but you can't have it like across town or something.
There's not a mileage perimeter, though. They don't spell that out. So it seems pretty vague.
Well, that's all the bullet points we have for that one. You guys ready for the next complaint?
John, you may not remember this, but we are always ready to move on to the next complaint. You know, that's what we do.
What are we doing right now? Is this a podcast?
Band rehearsal. Right. We are Earth, Wind, and Fire.
That's right. This is a band rehearsal. You are Earth. I don't know. I don't know who I am. I guess I'm gonna claim fire. Laurel's wind. Before John like makes a joke about me being an old windbag or something. Oh, I just self-owned myself. There, good job.
Yeah, I don't even have to say anything. I've just trained you to own yourself.
It works.
You old windbag.
Ouch. Move on. All
right. Bills and complaints. What's next?
All right. So the next complaint is also from the Trump state lawsuit. It is about clerks filling in missing information on absentee ballot envelopes. So this complaint has to do with, you know, between 4,000 and 5,500 ballots. And basically what happened here is when you have your absentee ballot envelope, you've got to have your signature and your address as a voter, and then you have to have the witness signature and the witness's address. In some cases, people were turning in their ballots with a missing address for either themselves or their witness. And clerks could, under current procedures established by the State Elections Commission, fill in that missing address information if they were able to get it from some sort of like official source, whether that was from the voter or if it was from like a government document or something. They could add that in to make it so the ballot envelope was filled out as necessary and valid to be counted.
So they're not adjusted. You know, the clerks were not allowed to adjust the ballots. This is just for the witness form.
The envelope that surrounds
the ballot. Which is what you said, but it's easy to like lump those together. And to be clear, it's for that portion. It's not for the ballot.
All right. Ballot envelopes. What's next?
Well, this complaint came from Trump's federal lawsuit. Moving on to a new lawsuit, guys. And this involved...
I don't remember that one.
Well, you're in for a treat, buddy. This involved drop boxes.
Ooh, drop boxes. Sorry, I'm getting kind of punchy. So drop boxes, these were new, I think it's safe to say, in 2020, or at least like to the extent that they were used was unprecedented in previous years. And these were just little drop boxes that communities use to make it easier to return your absentee ballot. You could take it to spot in your community and drop it in there and clerks would come get it. And I think, you know, pretty early on in the drop box usage era, some people were a little skeptical about, you know, leaving ballots in boxes, saying, okay, are these secure enough? Are they going to be picked up on time? You know, but the pushback was that they really did make it easier for a lot of people to return their ballots. And that was a goal for a lot of election officials as people were in record numbers figuring out how to vote by mail and not on election day for the first time in their lives.
Yeah, the common theme here, if they didn't want to worry about the post office getting their ballot to the clerk, this is a way they could hand deliver it themselves without going inside anywhere. Mm-hmm. And that's why they were in such demand. You know, we saw them all over Madison, I know. Mm-hmm. This is one where it's in the lawsuit, but the attorney for Republican legislative leaders, actually, when they sent kind of a threat about Democracy in the Park, like, don't do this, they never filed a lawsuit against it. But they sort of said, you know, you shouldn't do this. The attorney for Republicans did at that time say, we're okay with drop boxes. So at that point in the election cycle, it wasn't as controversial as it became once it got thrown into this lawsuit along with everything else.
And so what would this bill do to said drop boxes?
It's kind of interesting. It's pretty restrictive compared to what we saw in Madison. It says that they have to be attached to the clerk's office. So it couldn't be like a standalone drop box. Couldn't be at a library. And it's actually got to be at the clerk's office. So it would be a drop box.
And not just a practicable distance away from the clerk's office, but actually attached to the building itself?
Yes, has to be attached to the building itself.
And so if there's only one clerk's office in each city or town or whatever, this automatically means that there are fewer places for you to drop your ballots, right?
Yes.
I mean, is there pushback from Democrats, I'd assume, saying this makes it harder for people to vote?
I have not. So the pushback at this point hasn't been super specific, except for on the indefinitely confined voters, which disability rights groups do not like specifically. Mm-hmm. Broadly, so far you've seen Democrats say broadly, we don't like these bills. I haven't seen them get into the specifics of this one. But if you just kind of play it out, a small town could have the same number of drop boxes as a large city. So you could definitely see the inequities there.
All right, then. Well, moving on.
Moving on.
All right. So this next complaint, also part of the Trump federal lawsuit, is about grant money from organizations to governments to help with election administration.
Well, ooh, I'm having a breakthrough.
Okay.
Does this have to do with Mr. Facebook?
There you go.
Yes. Those memories are lodged in there somewhere, man. We're
Mr. Facebook, that's his name, right?
That's his name. Mark Zuckerberg and his wife formed this charity where they were spreading money around the country. I want to say it was like $300 million. They're spreading it to communities all over the U.S. to help run elections during the pandemic. And the focus of the Trump campaign's federal lawsuit was on this money that went to a handful of Democratic cities, Madison, Milwaukee, Racine. I'm going to stop because I can't remember the rest. Green Bay, I think.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it was one of them.
It was one of them. I want to say maybe Kenosha.
If I were to remember.
Kenosha, maybe?
Yeah, maybe. Yeah. Who remembers?
We can edit that out later if it's wrong. So their campaign focused on those cities, although the Zuckerberg grant money did go to communities throughout Wisconsin, as they argued in, you know, the briefs that they filed in court on this stuff.
So what's the change that Republicans want to make now to money from Mr. Facebook or from whoever?
So basically what the bill would do is put some restrictions on who gets the money that is directed toward, election operations in Wisconsin. It would make sure that the money was evenly divided between Wisconsin communities. It's not just some that get it. And it would give the state budget committee oversight over the money and the approval of it being sent out. So just kind of more requirements, more oversight, more involvement by the Capitol over this money that comes into the state.
All right, looking at the list here, it looks like we have one more complaint to get to before we get into some of the new bills that are tied more to general gripes.
General gripes.
A technical war hero. Designation.
This complaint, it's from the Trump federal lawsuit, and it dealt kind of generally with people who were observing the recount. So this one, Laurel and I both looked at this bill a few times and we're like, I'm not sure what this bill does exactly, but I think you landed on this, Laurel, that it looks like it creates a fine for people who violate existing observer rules.
Yeah. So, I mean, obviously election observation was a really big deal, particularly for the recount in Wisconsin, how close people were able to get to the election workers. This bill changes the distances that, you know, these observation areas can be set up in slightly, it seems.
The wording, but not like the minimum distance. You could be no closer than 3 feet before. And
right.
For voting, that remains the minimum. It doesn't like shorten it to a foot or something.
Right, exactly. It says in the bill summary that it expands the observation area. But existing legislation has that 3 foot minimum, as you mentioned, Sean, and an 8 foot maximum. So I don't see anything about the 8 foot maximum in this new proposal. So I'm wondering if maybe it does just lengthen the distance away that you could be, which doesn't seem to give people better access, but could make the observation area bigger, certainly, if it doesn't have to be ended at 8 feet.
Friends, I'm just going to say I looked at it and I'm confused. Yeah. I read it a couple times and I don't quite get what they're going at here.
But the you mentioned this, Sean, and I think that the misdemeanor penalty for being a disruptive observer is new. I don't think that there was any state level penalty for being a disruptive observer before. I think that was something that could be decided on a on a jurisdictional level, community by community, how that penalty would play out. So this would add a deterrent to being somebody that creates problems while you're trying to observe people voting or ballots being counted.
Well, that was a lot of time on a bill that we don't entirely understand.
Yeah.
Shall we move on?
Good job, guys. Yeah, let's move on. So since I remember nothing, what's the difference between all of these lawsuits that you've reminded me about and this other category we have called gripes?
Well, gripes, John, is not, to my knowledge, a technical term. It is not a legal term. You don't have like a gripe motion or there's not a formal gripe. These are just like, you know, they could have been complaints. They could have been lawsuits, but they weren't. So they are stuff we've heard about specifically from Republicans, and they've now found their way into bills. I'm not even sure if the "Do you remember" theme works for this exactly, because there was no lawsuit. But can we play it anyway?
Yeah, I mean, Earth, Wind, and Fire is probably the best band in history. So let's roll that tape.
Okay, good. Here's one of the gripes we heard about was involving nursing homes. And I think we heard the gripe kind of loudly at a hearing that you covered, Laurel, after the election.
Yeah, so this was the first election investigation hearing that Speaker Voss called to look into election administration after the presidential election. And a number of invited speakers came and testified, and they were mostly Republican lawyers by percentage. There were also some Republican officials, a Republican member of the State Elections Commission.
Republican activists,
a very partisan group providing testimony. One of the individuals was a talk radio host, Dan O'Donnell, a conservative talk radio host, and he talked a lot about people who had contacted him. He couldn't provide their names or additional details about them, but he said that he had heard from people that said their relatives who lived in nursing homes were coerced to vote a certain way. And so under this bill, there would be penalties for staff, felony penalties, actually, for staff that attempt to influence a nursing home resident's voting behavior. And there would also be a requirement that nursing home administrators contact family members when official special voting deputies, they're called, from the state come in to help people with voting ahead of elections.
And the way this one's worded, to my eye, is that staff who influence people to vote are guilty of this felony. You know, that you don't have to say, hey, you know, resident, I think you should vote for Joe Biden, and here's your ballot. They can just say, I think you should vote. Here's a ballot. Choose who you want. And that would be guilty of this felony, is my reading of this bill. Yours too?
Yeah.
Yep.
Yes. Yeah.
So the felony part is if members of the staff encourage residents to vote. But you also mentioned in there that family members of residents would have to be notified if these voting deputies come to assist voters. Is that sort of assuming that everybody who lives in a nursing home is somehow incapacitated and that their family needs to know if they're voting?
I mean, that's definitely a conversation that I have heard in State Elections Commission meetings that, you know, putting more family oversight over voting practices at nursing homes in response to some concerns that some people have is placing a judgment on residents that they are not capable of exercising their right to vote without someone else being involved. I know, you know, Elections Commission Administrator Ann Jacobs, who's the chair right now, a Democratic appointee, really pushed back on that strongly in a meeting that I listened to, saying, like, these are adults that have the right to vote, and there doesn't need to be this additional level of, bureaucracy over them, that they should be able to do this without a family member being notified or having to come in or anything like that.
All right. Yeah. Interesting. That just stood out to me. But keeping things moving. Next gripe.
The next gripe is just kind of generally about the Wisconsin Elections Commission.
Yeah. People don't like them.
Well, I mean, Republicans seem to be the people who don't like them now. And it's interesting because Republicans created this commission, you know, it replaced the Government Accountability Board, which was run by reserve judges. Republicans felt like they were too partisan. It was supposed to be this nonpartisan board, that the judges were too partisan, that they were going after conservatives, going after Scott Walker, the John Doe investigation. It's a long story. They created this Wisconsin Elections Commission, which is split evenly between three Republicans, three Democrats. And, you know, staff does a lot of the heavy lifting on this commission. And it seems like this is just something to kind of keep tabs on the Wisconsin Elections Commission. This bill would require the commission to basically post their meeting notes ASAP and on the internet. And that's what I have to say about that. I mean, it's if you're a Republican and you're checking off the boxes of stuff that some of your constituents are mad about, this is one of those boxes.
All right. Well, should we play some more Earth, Wind, and Fire and then move on to mail?
I'm sure that a person who's listening to the podcast at this point is like, I hope they play a little snippet of that song for the 13th time. That's what I'm really here for.
I would just like to say we are so deep into this that anyone still listening to this podcast deserves,
if you're still listening,
a medal.
It's pretty dry material too at this point. So yeah. Bravo. Good job.
I salute you. So male.
And male. Not in the gender kind of way, but like the stuff you put in a mailbox.
Right. So one of these bills, a provision in one of these bills would allow you to use a for-profit commercial delivery service to deliver your absentee ballot. So using something like UPS or FedEx instead of the U.S. Postal Service would be okay to do, which I wasn't totally aware that it wasn't okay to do before. But Sean had a good point when we were talking about this, which is if you don't use the U.S. Postal Service, you don't have a postmark, which we know postmarks came up in court challenges about voting during the pandemic. So there you go. Mail.
Keep it moving.
All right, what's next?
There we go. Ballot harvesting. This the concept of like one person collecting other people's ballots to turn them in, their absentee ballots. So we know this is an issue that the Wisconsin Institute for Law and Liberty brought up before the election. They wanted to make it clear that like ballot harvesting was not allowed. That didn't turn into a lawsuit exactly. The term was referenced, I think, in some of the lawsuits. But this bill is a pretty significant bill if you read the details. Laurel, that's your cue. Laurel was reading something else because she thought I was going to take this bill. Laurel.
You called me out. I'm so sorry. I was reading about payroll changes.
Okay, I'll take it from here then, okay? It's significant. Trust me, Laurel would tell you this if she had the document in front of her. This does a couple things. It bans anybody who's not a family member or legal guardian from returning a ballot. So, John, if I fill out my absentee ballot, I couldn't ask you to run it to the Dropbox, which is attached to the clerk's office, right? Also, because we're like brothers, but we're not actually brothers. That's why. Also, if you return a ballot, you can only do it for one person. So if you're trying to do your parents a favor, you're going to have to, your elderly parents, let's say, you would have to pick your parent, is my read of this. Like you could take a ballot back for mom, but not for dad, or vice versa. Oh, and what's the last bit there? Laurel, you don't even have the document up, but what's the punishment? I'll let you guess.
I have the document up now. The punishment is a Class I felony, which is the punishment for a lot of these bills, for violating provisions in these bills, which is imprisonment up to 3.5 years or a $10,000 fine.
Yep. There you go.
This is where I insert Laurel's dogs barking again because they're concerned about felonies.
Yeah.
All right. What's the next one?
All right. So next is a provision that has to do with poll workers and who can be a poll worker. You know, this is in response to some people having concerns about poll workers not being having bad motivations, right? Having some sort of political agenda and so not doing their jobs to the letter of the law. Under this bill, people who have official professional affiliations with different political groups, like a political party or a PAC or even an advocacy group, could not serve as poll workers in Wisconsin. They would be disqualified.
I imagine in the past, some of those people have volunteered as poll workers.
I think they might have, yeah. And, you know, it's worth
it seems
pointing
possible
out
that, when there are shortages of poll workers. Yeah.
Yeah, that's what I was going to. Yeah, we've had some shortages of poll workers recently. So
last year, especially.
This would limit the pool of people who could be poll workers.
All right. Well, we're almost done here, folks. Last bullet point and sub bullet point. We have fraud.
This is definitely a gripe and not a complaint because the lawsuits filed by the Trump campaign did not allege specific acts of fraud, to be clear. But this bill provision would create a class I felony for miscounting ballots, basically. And it goes through a few ways in which ballots could be miscounted. But essentially, we're doing it wrong when you know it's right. Or doing it right when you know it's wrong. That's fraud in this bill. And class I fraud at that.
That's actually a Earth, Wind, and Fire B-side. When you're doing it wrong, but you know that it's right. Doing it
honestly,
right,
it could
you know
be.
That it's wrong. You're going to jail for at least 3.5 years.
I will say, we got pretty poetic there at the end.
Also, I think it's up to 3.5 years, not at least
yeah,
three.
It's not mandatory. Oh,
well,
right.
Then. I mean, you know, they're taking in, you know, artistic license with their lyrics.
Oh, sure. Right. Right.
Right. What's that thing that you actually read about the lyrics, John? Oh, my God.
I can't read that. That has some cowboy language on it.
Okay.
But if you're interested, go to the Wikipedia page about the Earth, Wind, and Fire song. September has a nice anecdote about the writing process.
Yeah,
that's your Easter egg for making it this far.
Here's another Easter egg. There is this guy who does a really funny video every year on September 21st, and it's just him dancing to this song in increasingly elaborate ways. So go look for it on the YouTubes. It's good.
Well, guys, this has been a conversation. What are we going to talk about this week?
I know it's a joke, John, but I can't talk about this anymore. I'm sorry. I'm spent.
This was a journey we went on together. We made it.
Well, Sean Johnson is WPR's Capitol Bureau Chief.
Laurel White is WPR's Capitol Reporter.
And John K. Wilson is our resident politics nerd. Even if he doesn't remember politics.
John, you're a nerd. I don't know if you remember that.
He's our resident nerd.
Whatever. I'm secretly a member of Earth, Wind, and Fire, so that's cool. Do you remember? With the world as wacky as it is these days, it can be hard to remember to do even some of the most basic things in life, like keeping up with your favorite podcasts. But do not fret, because you can get new episodes of the WPR Politics Podcast delivered to you almost every single week without even having to think about it when you subscribe to the show. It's available on Apple Podcasts, Google, Stitcher, Spotify, and many other podcast apps. While you're there, leave a rating or review of the show to help other people find it. And if you are having trouble remembering the last 4+ years of Wisconsin political news, well, you are in luck. You can catch up on all of our past episodes anytime at wpr.org/politicspodcast.